check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one, news, views, and hip-hop.
This is Sister Soulja on Hard Knock Radio. Listen closely.
¿Qué pasa, raza? This is Deuce Eclipse, the Oi Joaquin, yo parte chino. Check it out. Listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Hey, this is Patrice Rushen. And whenever I'm in the Bay Area and I need good information and great radio, it's all about Hard Knock Radio.
And again, you're tuned to Hard Knock here on the Pacifica Network. Up next, we continue with part two of our conversation from yesterday, exploring families impacted by police terror and demanding police accountability. Presented by the Love Not Blood campaign last week, they hosted the Verdict Day commemoration with a panel discussion moderated by Hard Knock Radio's own Davey D. Stay tuned as we listen to part two of the conversation regarding police terror and accountability.
He said once that democracy presupposes an enlightened electorate. And in this government that we live in, theoretically, every elected official that you see is your representative. We make the mistake of waiting for the elected officials to lead us rather than we to lead the elected officials. So when that moment unfolded, when we began to become aware what happened with Oscar on January the 3rd, that Saturday, by that following Monday, the question was raised by my twin brother in San Francisco, who was Brother Christopher Muhammad at the time, and he raised the question, isn't there a group of black elected officials that you are part of, that group in Oakland, that should speak to this? What is the group's position? Well, no one in the group had called me. So as a member of the group at the time, I began making calls. We organized a meeting that emerged that following Tuesday at Olivet. And whether you know it or not, there is an organization in this area called the Black Elected Officials of the East Bay, headed by County Supervisor Keith Carson. And nearly any black elected official in Northern California is either a part of that group or has had their campaign supported by that group. The problem that we live with is that we've been, as a people once, who have waited for elected officials to do for us things that we should make for them to do. So they respected the position of lead that we took. In that group was Councilwoman Desley Brooks, who was present. And when we began to sit down and raise the questions of what we knew and what was being done, instantly, she said, I can call the DA and find out right now. So she called Mr. Orloff, got him on the phone, told him that there's a group of elected officials and clergy leaders that would like to learn from you what's happening in the case of Oscar Grant. His reaction was, in essence, I don't need to talk to them. She pressed him in a Desley Brooks kind of way. And after the pressing, he said, well, I'll meet with two or three of you. There were about 20 of us in the room. She held up her speakerphone and let us answer him collectively that he was either going to meet us all, which was about 20 of us at that time.
It was more than us, more than 20.
In that room. Well, the number grew. It started at a number and it grew as the noon hour came. But we took the position all or nothing at all. So since he said he didn't want to meet, we agreed that we would have a press conference on Wednesday morning of Oscar's funeral. And we would do it on the steps of the Alameda County Courthouse. By that time, the number had expanded to a little over 100. Yeah. And then we went up to his office to demand the meeting that he refused. It was then that he accepted to speak with two people. And that would be County Supervisor Keith Carson, who was actually tied up in a county budget hearing, and he was the chair of the meeting. On an emergency note, he left the meeting at the call of the DA. He came over to the DA's office to see the DA and what he wanted, and when he came off the elevator, his first stop was to stop to those that called for the meeting in the first place, which was me. What do you want us to do? Well, go in and talk to him. Tell him we need to talk to him. Well, he went in with J. Alfred Smith, my pastor and friend from Allen Temple. They came back out and invite me into that dialogue. Once we entered that dialogue, the next question was, where are we going to meet? When are we going to meet? Because the DA was afraid to come out and speak to the activists. There was a lobby full of activists. Yeah. We told him, you can come right out here and tell the public what you intend to do and let us question you. I'm not going out there. Why not? In essence, I fear for my safety even though I'm in a police station. I'm secured by all the county sheriffs. There's an office across the street. You're in a courthouse. He feared for his safety to come out into that lobby. I said to him, well, why don't you open up an empty courtroom? I'm sure we can fit in there. He refused to do that. So he thought it through. Somebody suggested a conference room where we ended up. And we brought what remained of that rally into that conference room, which by that point, there were more elected officials present, included, when I looked at the photographs, the chief of staff of Mayor Dellums, somebody from Congresswoman Lee's office was in that crowd. Of course, there were a number of activists who had not gone to the services and elected officials that were still there, most notably Keith Carson, Desley Brooks, Reverend Buford from Allen Temple, and quite a few others. But there were elected official staffs in earshot. They didn't speak in the meeting. They listened to the meeting. Well, the very next day, after the heated evening, when Dellums is in the street.
Right.
If you want me to keep going.
Well, I'm gonna hold you right there because I want to bring in Sister Cap Brooks on this. And I want us to just kind of all reflect on this. And there are pictures and there's videos online to see this gathering of people. And I was at that meeting. I went in there because they said no press. So
David did.
No, but I didn't pretend to be activist. But the press got the video because I filmed it and we gave it to them. So we controlled that narrative initially. You know, it's like we gave it to John Sasaki from KTVU, and it was like, this is what happened, and, you know, and it was an understanding that you're going to follow what the narrative was from that meeting, which is important, too, but we can get to that later. But I want us to reflect on the fact that we had these power brokers, and you had this one guy say no, pretty much, which brings the question to you, Kat. Let's talk about some of the things that were going on the streets. Oftentimes, people will say, well, the riots and the breaking of glass and people, you know, acting uncivilly, it harms the movement. But I would say that, and it was said, that movement was made because people tore up Oakland. So let's talk a little bit about that, your understanding of being an activist, being somebody out on the streets, and how that really moves things and what we need to know about that. And talk about your involvement in this movement.
So nothing is ever black or white, right? Except for white supremacy and black oppression. And so it goes with what took place in the streets and how things took place in the streets, right? Oftentimes when things like this happen, and it did happen in this case too, right? Like, organizers, activists come together. And so for the first 3 weeks, there was an organization that came together, a coalition against police executions. That was primarily made up of folks that were employed by the nonprofit world, right? That dynamic, however, was not controlling what was happening on those streets. What was beautiful about the initial resistance, we call them rebellions, we do not call them riots. Riots imply that the rage is not righteous. Is that it was born of the people, right? People have to, it's hard, I think, for some people, particularly people that are new to Oakland, new in the last couple of years, for you to grasp the savagery of the Oakland Police Department and the ways in which that they were murdering and brutalizing and raping and terrorizing community members left, right, and center. And so when Oscar's execution was caught, what happened was a groundswell of righteous rage that was born particularly into the streets of young black men who were the primary targets of the Oakland Police Department, right? That was what you initially saw on the streets. And you saw then you saw a group of people, and we've had this conversation, a group of people that are not impacted by police violence, a group of people who do not walk down the street every day fearing for their lives, a group of people that aren't necessarily even part of the economic class that is the most impacted by police violence, capitalize on the rage of black men. And what you saw, what I saw with my own two eyes, and which I say unapologetically repeatedly, is white folks who had sense enough to be masked up, walk black bodies to windows, put rocks in their hands and point. What I saw was white people burning things down and tearing things up, and then when I logged onto the Oakland Police Department website, wasn't a white face they was looking for. It was black boys and men that they were looking for. And even that wouldn't have been as problematic had then those white folks used their resources to take care of these black boys and men. And so what emerged out of that was a tension, but ultimately what ended up being a very critical conversation between the white left and black organizers and activists. And the things that aren't caught in videos, right, that aren't on tape, and which we haven't done a very good job chronicling that we need to, were the hours and hours of behind-the-scenes conversations in hot, tense, sweaty rooms where we tried to hammer out principles of engagement, right? Which ultimately ended up being, when we call what we call, we're going to call it from this time to this time. And then you will let us get our mothers and our grandmothers and our children out the cut before you act a fool. And I want to point to my brother, Terha Ak, over here, because this is another part of the story that does not get told. And that was OPD's response to us being in those streets. Whether we were marching peacefully, whether we were praying civilly, or whether we were righteously raging up and down the streets of Oakland, the response of the Oakland Police Department was brutal, savage, ultimately proven to be illegal, right? And changed the caveats with which they're supposed to operate and set them back many years on their federal receivership. But it was brothers like Terha Ak and Che and the security forces in the nation that were literally pulling people out of what looked like a war zone, fighting tear gas to go in there and pull black bodies out and black mothers and black babies out, right?
Hold that thought for a second. You know, you use the word war zone, and I don't want that to be glossed over. Because, and you can speak to this. Tear gas every night? Am I right or wrong?
Every night. Tear gas, flashbang grenades, and physical assaults.
As a journalist, right, the way I had to protect myself was I had to, like, literally align myself. That was the agreement I had with KTVU. I'm going to roll with you guys because if I'm by myself, there's hell to be paid. Your equipment would get broken, and I've had that happen. You'd get tear gas. You'd get arrested, and there were several journalists that were arrested, right, because they didn't look like journalists and didn't have the passes and everything. So there was an awareness that you had to protect yourself, and I wanted me people to understand the tear gas, the brutality, the mass arrests were a regular occurrence, and that was not always captured and articulated. I don't want to stop you there. But
okay, so to circle back to your point, David D., absolutely, there is no way that Johannes Mezley would have been arrested, tried, convicted, were it not for the righteous rage that exploded in the streets of Oakland and for people that put their bodies on the line every single day. You know, I talk about this from a personal point of view. Carol Terha's wife raised my daughter for 3 years. Because we were in the streets that long. And that's the other thing that I think is really important is that people forget that that was a 3-year protracted struggle with the state. He did not kill him in 2009, right? And then in January and then February was all good. It was consistent organizing, consistent struggle, consistent engagement, consistently being in the streets, consistently being in meetings, consistently dealing with the media, consistently always, always, always dealing with each other, right? Because movement is messy and struggle is hard. And we're all traumatized. And I want to say one more thing back, and then I'll stop. I want to go back to what you said about us not getting the coverage we needed. Were there no Oakland, there was no Ferguson. Were there no Oakland, there was no Ferguson. The biggest difference, the only difference between Ferguson, actually there's two major differences between Ferguson and Oakland. Ferguson got the media coverage, right? And the length of time the folks were in the streets. And no disrespect, all love to my Ferguson comrades, right? But Ferguson was not the first city to have tanks roll down the street to face off the protesters. Ferguson was not the first city. We had we used to do the salute, forgive me, minister, you remember this. We'd have all the people out there, right? And we did what I called the salute. And it went like this. That building, that building, that building, and that building.
Middle finger in the air.
And we did, well, it was two fingers, but I got a mic in my hand. And I was younger, a little more hyphy then. But we were flipping off the snipers that were on top of the building with their trained machine guns and AK-47s and AR-15s at our heads. That happened here in Oakland. And it was our perseverance through that, our commitment, our structure, our strategic organizing, tactical decisions, and willingness to struggle that ultimately landed Meserly in jail and birthed what has been the next 10 years of a national push to shift the dialogue around police terror in this country. Oakland owns that.
Minister Keith, let's talk. Appreciate that. I want to bring another angle into this protracted struggle. And there's a legislative angle to it. If you go back to 2009, there were several narratives that people often said, we're the feds, right? So people are borrowing from the 60s. We need to bring the feds in. But also, let's paint the picture. Barack Obama is in office, and he has a black attorney general, right? An attorney general named Eric Holder, who initially said, we need to have a conversation about race, and then Obama shut it down, right? But there was an understanding, or at least a perception, that now you had some friendly folks that were willing to do some things, right? So I recall talking to you and you telling me about some of the battles that you had incurred going up to Sacramento and, you know, trying to get some things pushed, right, with the black president. And if you could talk to the people about the pushback, especially in the form of police unions that showed up in force. And I remember you telling me every police union backed Meserly. There was no support. So let's talk a little bit about that protracted struggle to try and get things done legally and what you all ran into.
One of the first demands made by the organizers that were pulling together the town hall meetings was that all of retire, resign, or face a recall. Every effort we made toward filing that recall was rebuffed at the county office, and the last effort we made was rebuffed at the Oakland Tribune. So we knew that there were forces operating here, and that we were told that there needed to be a couple of dozen signatures to make the file at the county. They came back and told us everybody wasn't registered at the addresses that they fine-tooth combed the signatures, and were bouncing it around. Sister Beatrice met somebody who worked in the office there, and she sat with them to clear every signature that we secured for the recall. When we finally had the signatures needed, we filed the documents which required a posting in the Oakland or a newspaper. We paid for the posting online and delivered it to the Oakland Tribune electronically, only to find out they never published what was required to be published in order to make the recall. I was out of town. I took a day off, which was rare. Took my family down to Monterey, was getting ready to go to the beach, and something said, check the Oakland Tribune. And when I called, because I looked online and saw what I sent them, but the published paper never printed the form to announce the recall drive. I came back from Monterey instantly to find out when I got to the Tribune, is in the same building that Mr. Burris's office is or was at that time. I get there, and rather than answer my question about did you receive the documents, when are they going to be published, they said, we got to go get an attorney to come and talk to you. Okay, well, never mind. I'm out of here. I see where this is going. And from that point onward, our organizing effort said, we have to go higher in the chain of politics to get an answer to this problem. The town hall meetings began developing in most of the cities most notably where there was police brutality. So we found town halls in Stockton, town halls in Vallejo, town halls in Antioch, town halls wherever our people were gathering. And those town halls at a certain point united to go to Sacramento with what we called the Caravan for Justice. Yeah, yeah. And we were seeking not only to address the issue of police brutality, but to put all of our issues on the table. Those town halls gathered the first time about 5,000 people at the state's capital. When we got there, we were met with a full phalanx of law enforcement, horseback, riot gear, everything that you could imagine, snipers on the roofs for this peaceful rally. Thanks be to Allah, we certainly didn't go with any fear. So we said to the rally, follow us into the state's capital. They hadn't seen anything like it since the Panthers walked through with guns. We didn't walk through with guns. We walked in with about 1,000 people. Took over one of the areas inside, I don't know what you call it, but the rotunda inside the building, and had a small rally inside the building. And they were certainly on alert. Now, those three Caravan for Justice produced the first time ever of all of the caucuses that represent minority groups coming together in unity. We forced to the table by our presence the Latino caucus, the Asian caucus, the Black caucus, and the Progressive caucus, all to consider the subject of police brutality. When a bill finally came before them, the first was the bill that produced BART Oversight Review Board. Unfortunately, our brother Swanson allowed that bill to be watered down before it got to the bottom line. So that's the down and dirty part of politics. You go in writing one thing and you come out with another thing. They knew when to get me out of the conversation, and that's when they began editing, cutting, and amending. And by the time they'd done that, the BART board had its teeth removed. It's very difficult to chew for justice without teeth. So they removed the teeth out of that bill. But the police unions, whenever we arrived, it was clear that they were in full support of whatever the police have done. You've never seen the police union say anything ill of anything that a police officer has ever done. So now that they're arresting cops, there's a cop recently arrested for raping 16-year-old homeless girls, I think out in the East Coast. You don't hear the police union. Now, you could call us anti-police. I would say that those police unions that don't demand justice are anti-justice. So rather than calling us anti-everything, why don't they deal with the subjects that we're dealing with? We're dealing with the blood of the innocent that have been shed by officers that are wrong and officers who are guilty. Yeah. And if these that are police organizers had any kind of heart in them, regardless of race, so this is not a subject of race, but it just so happens that the victims of most of the murders are Black people. But those that are police union heads, I don't recall ever seeing a Black police union head. There could be someone out in Mississippi somewhere, I just haven't met. But when they start organizing, you have to know that they are one of the most potent organizing forces in a state. Now stop with this. Jerry Brown told us when they unfolded Operation Nutcracker at Acorn, we had a private meeting with him. Desley Brooks, Jerry Brown, myself, and Minister Christopher, and a couple of others. Because he called our young people, when he was attorney general, terrorists involved in asymmetrical warfare. In other words, let's rain down the full force of the federal law enforcement authorities on every young person in West Oakland. When we challenged him by putting his own words in front of him, we said to him that you said that the incarceration rate is not due to crime, it's due to the failure of capitalism. That's what he said when he was a KPFA. So he put his own words in front of him and challenged him. And he said, you're right. Now, this is a private meeting. They shut down the state building while we were talking to him.
Yeah.
The security left him with us.
The Muslims.
They turn the lights out. Now, literally, 5 o'clock, the lights go out, the security leaves, and it's the Muslims, Desley Brooks, and Jerry Brown. And this is what he said. He said, "You're right, but if you can organize a force that's stronger than the force in words that's driving my mouth, then I'll listen to you." That's what caused us to organize the town halls. We were seeking to organize a force.
I'm going to leave that there, and I want you all to reflect on that. Those behind-the-scenes meetings are very revealing. I've had a couple with Jerry Brown myself that is like, wow, he's an interesting guy. One of the highlights of the Oscar Grant movement was unity. And let me preface that. I think there was an understanding that if we talk nationally, and we were on Al Sharpton show and others, right?
Yes.
If there was a split between anybody, you know, you had the communist cats, right? Revolution, RCP, and people on the street, and church folks, and whatever. If there was any national media, we were like, everybody in Oakland is united, right? That was the narrative, right? And I recall we was on Al Sharpton's show, and they were trying to put that wedge in there, and it's like, no, everybody in Oakland's on the same page, and that was inspiring to people. And to a large degree, from the distance looking out, there was unity, which I want to bring this question to you, Kat, or maybe Taha can talk a little bit about it. How were you all able to maintain a sense of that, considering all the different formations of people that were moving? You had Asian folks that were moving. You had folks calling for revolution. You had folks that just wanted to tear it up. Street folks, church folks, you know, Muslims, Catholics, you know. How were you all able to keep some of that together for 18 months, for 2 years, right? And in the middle of those, in the middle of that, we had other disruptions, other police killings, most notably the four police over here, which brought in new folks that wanted to have something to say about the argument, and you had national folks. And you recall when we were on Al Sharpton's show, he was trying to see, literally make a deal. So some of these national folks wanted to make a deal, like, as soon as we get off, let's talk, and can you write a check? So you had that. You had folks from Fox that were trying to get folks on there, and all of us stood down and wouldn't go on that. So how were you all able to do this organizing piece that we can learn from to really have kept everybody together?
I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
I heard there was some of those type of conversations too. That's what I heard.
Yeah, and I'm only, I mean, of course I would never kill David E. or anybody else, but I'm only half, like, there's some stuff that I will talk about publicly, and then there's some stuff that I won't, because A, is not necessary. B, is not necessary. What I will say is that so there was not unity across the board, and there was a lot of mess. I will say, though, that everybody, and I can say this even about the people that I don't ideologically or politically necessarily agree with, everybody was committed to justice for Oscar. Everybody. Now, how you got there, or how you thought we were going to get there, or what you also wanted to extract for yourself in the process, right, very wildly. But everybody, I really can. Even people, like, I have wild differences with the RCP, right? As does most of the Bay Area. But I can't even say that those fools were not sincerely interested in getting justice for Oscar. And I think that as the movement continued to build, that we actually saw a pathway, right? When we figured out, so as the nation and the family were going back and forth from LA to Oakland, we, the organizers on the ground, were also going back and forth from Oakland to Los Angeles. We had networks. I was driving to LA and breaking folks off that place so that they could live out there behind donut shops in South Central. And so I think as we saw that was a possibility, that became the primary goal. I think also that the primary actors out of all of the functions, be it the anarchists or the, what were we called then, the black nationalists, we were all being successful in our particular arenas, right? And so that allowed us to have some tolerance with each other. But I think the most important thing, and I've been hammering on this everywhere I speak because I'm very concerned about what our movement looks like 20 years from now, is what we had in the Oscar Grant movement and what Oakland was plentiful with at that time were organizers. Those of us who are trained in organizing. Organizing is a craft. It is a discipline. It requires study and practice. It is not an advocate. It is not an activist. So the people that understand how to identify power, how to leverage power, what a target is, how to mobilize a base, how to keep people engaged, we had organizers in that movement. And because of that, it allowed for a level of discipline and focus and strategy and tactical accuracy that I think otherwise we would not have gotten the outcome that, you know, we got. And we did. We had, and I got to give it to even the people I do not politically agree with. I mentioned it earlier. There were long, hard meetings. I mean, I think of one and that was at Siegel and Yee that was literally, see, I'm not going to tell that part, but 5.5 hours of us in a room together because we refused to leave until we knew that the next time we were in the streets together, that we were gonna be on the same page. And so folks being willing to come to the table, folks being willing to force people to come to the table, that's what did it.
I know we're gonna wrap up, but I want us to, for a moment, just reflect on that, because I think that is the untold and a very important story. 5.5 hour meetings. Constant meetings, constant town halls, right? The way that movements are presented to us in school and in documentaries is like somebody gets angry, next thing you know, the Panthers are here, right? People get angry and King is having a speech on the monument, you know, Washington Monument. But what's not told are these long, long meetings. And in this case, I think it's something that we should all pick up from is that you all did struggle with these conversations, that you all did try to figure out how to get from point A to point B. And that's important at a time when we look for instant gratification.
Because I know Bobby wants to stop, and I know we have other stuff to do, and Terhan wants to say one thing. I just want to complete my point around, that's why I say I'm concerned, is because what we have then been breeding post-Ferguson and post-BLM are advocates and activists and not organizers. Right, we are not training our next generation of organizers, but people are bastardizing that word. And that's not set from a place of arrogance. That's set from a place of deep love for our people and deep concern when in 20 years, or sooner by the grace of God, right, myself and others exit out and make room for these youngsters to be on the front line. Right, it is not replicating a screaming. That is not what happened. We did not just go scream our way to victory. So I keep feel like I've got to hammer that.
Yeah, Toha, you want to add something to this since your name has come up like 25 times? Step over here.
One of the things that I think was critical, though, and that I want to make sure doesn't get left out of the conversation.
Go for the mic.
And is not said enough, particularly about the organizing that has happened and does happen in Oakland and in the Bay Area. And Kat hit on it, is that there were astute, knowledgeable, experienced organizers, but there's a respect, right? And I wanna, it's something that's very subtle, but it exists. There was always an understanding in every one of those rooms that we were in that there's disagreements and struggle. There's disagreements and movements. There's always tension between ideological approaches, who's gonna do what, who's gonna play what role. But it was always an unspoken understanding that if it went down over there, we going over there. If it's going out over here, they coming over here. It was always that understanding, even when we didn't talk about it.
That's right.
And it hasn't been spoken on enough, right? It's one of the reasons I feel confident to struggle in the Bay Area around the differences in approaches, because it's like family.
Right.
That even though we're struggling, you can't come in here and do nothing.
Right.
And that's the police and anybody else. Right? It's always an understanding. If you touch Uncle Bobby, we got an issue. Right? If you at the mosque, we got an issue. Right? And so I just wanted that is an underemphasized reality of why it worked and why it works to this day.
And that's the word I was using. That's how I was describing unity. Right? That deep respect. You know, an entire book and maybe a movie or something needs to be done about that, because there's so many lessons that need to be learned But let's give it up for our panel right here for sharing a little bit. I'm going to turn it over to Uncle Bobby as we bring on our next person, which is our lawyer, you know, John Burris. Let's give it up for him.
Definitely, again, let's recognize Minister Sabor, of course, our sister Kat, our brother Tarhawk, and of course, our moderator, David D. Clap it up for him. Thank you. And of course, our rep here, John Burris, is going to share a few words with you. He actually is on a timeline. He has to, I believe, go to Vallejo.
He got good, though.
You good? But the whole point of this is for John to kind of reflect also back in time, back in the Oscar Grant movement, the lessons learned and some of the don'ts and, of course, the do's. And, you know, so that we can just all kind of, again, step back in time, look at what worked, what didn't work, and where we can go today to make things better for us all. John.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Actually, I look around the room, I see a lot of very, very familiar faces, some of whom I represent, others who have been in the struggle that I've been involved in for many, many years. Some of you probably not around as when I first started doing this, but when the first real protesting took place around the shooting was the Melvin Black case, which was in 1979. And he was a 14-year-old black kid who was shot right off of 51st Street here by Children's Hospital as he was running away. He was shot multiple times. Kat probably remember that. He was shot many, many times in the back.
I remember reading about it.
Okay. Well, you weren't there. But there was a massive amount of protesting that took place at the time. And what came out of that was a citizen review board that ultimately was kind of a model for the country. But it was about the community rising up and protesting and basically saying that the shooting that took place and the manner in which it took place and the explanation that the police gave was just not believable and was offensive to all of us. I happened to be surprisingly asked to be a special investigator for the city of Oakland at the time. And unlike everyone else who was involved in the investigation, including the city of U.S. attorney and the city attorney and the district attorney's office, I concluded that the shooting was wrong and the tactics employed were, in fact, troubling. And that sort of gave me a real sense about, one, what to do in these types of cases as a lawyer, and two, what the community can do in terms of standing up and protesting when these happen. I'm a strong believer, of course, that protesting does matter, that you have to ask for the question, present the question, and you have to hold people accountable. And so, you know, before I got to Oscar Grant, I was involved in the Rodney King case, and you all know how that was in terms of community outrage and protesting, you know, the consequence of that. It ultimately caused for the Christopher Commission to take place in Los Angeles, and it really had a dramatic impact in impacting the way LAPD was policing. Of course, it didn't correct the problem. But going forward, we had another example, which wasn't as much protesting, but it certainly served as a basis on what could be done. And that was the Oakland Riders case, which I have been involved in for a number of years. But it also showed that if you have a plan, you have a purpose, and you go to the people with your plan and your purpose, you can get something done. Now, it doesn't hurt if you have a legal matter involved, too. That always helps. You cannot run from the fact that there's a case that's pending. So when Oscar's case came and occurred on that fateful morning, it was very clear to me that morning when I first found out about it, this was bigger than big. Because you have a young man who was shot down in the back, who appeared to be helpless, who appeared to be in compliance, and gets killed. And certainly the cell phone videos that surfaced immediately really just aroused the nation, certainly our community, the people on the train were just who happened to see it were mystified. And that was, it was the shock of it all to everyone that really, I think, caused, became underpinning of what took place in terms of the protesting. And certainly from the very beginning, I can remember that Sunday, two days later, we're at my office and we're talking about it. And from there you could see and feel that this is going to be different and that the community was going to rise up and we're not going to take this. Immediately, and we said this before, but immediately it was clear that this man, Mesley, needed to be prosecuted. He needed to be prosecuted for murder. This was something that the way the community came together around this was pretty remarkable because there had not been any police shootings where an officer had been prosecuted. Now, by 2009, I'd been involved in maybe 50 police shootings around the area. And nobody had ever been close to prosecution. I sent letters after letters to the district attorney's office, the U.S. attorney's office, and Washington's Justice Department. Never did we get anyone to be prosecuted. But I think it's because the community was so adamant, and also because there were political people involved as well. Because when the city council people got involved, and there were other political leaders, board of supervisors, people like that. And then, of course, there was the national outcry. It forced the district attorney to do something he clearly was not planning to do. And Mesley, when it was clear he was going to get indicted, he took off and was gone. But the most important aspect of that that caused him to want to prosecute was the community outrage. Community's willingness to come together for meetings after meetings, and finally the district attorney just gave it up, which was rare. He gave it up. Now, he should have given it up. It shouldn't have to have been forced that kind of way, because what happened to Oscar was so blatantly murdered that there was no justification for it. So that organized around that. And I think that the more important part about all that, there was this desire for the prosecution. People came together around that and let it be known to all the public officials that this was a case where prostitution should occur. It also was clear that the public at large even was for prosecution as well. And I must tell you, like you will learn over time as you have not, just because you're for something, I can tell you there's another side that's totally against it. And the police officers were not, the police community, the law enforcement community, was not for the prosecution. And that's, if I can tell you any lessons that will come out of this, that case, which has certainly been my experience, is it doesn't matter how bad the facts are, it doesn't matter how bad they are, or and how egregious they are, the law enforcement community will find a way to support the officer, period. So you should not ever get confused about that. Because at the end of the day, you have to force the issue. And you can do that through organizations. You have to present that case. But you got to remember that the forces who are listening to it may not be inclined to hear what you have to say. So you have to keep forcing going forward. Now, I'm very fortunate because you got to hear me. I'm going to have a case. So you got to hear me. But in terms of making me more effective, it really is the community support. It's really the community organizing that's going to the mayor's office. Going to the police station, it's going to the city council meeting, and letting it be known this conduct is unacceptable. Yeah. And also, I think, have to have a plan. Fortunately, in the Oscar case, there was a plan. One, we wanted to prosecute it. But then secondly, there was a whole question of what we're going to do about Bart and putting the pressure on Bart. And what came about that is that ultimately an independent organization, an independent firm, conducted an internal investigation, which is kind of rare. Then from that, a lot of reforms in terms of the evaluation of the department came about. That can happen. That clearly can happen. So you can put the kind of pressure on a department that they have to make adjustments, but you got to understand what kind of adjustments you want and kind of pressure you want. And I see Petey over here, Petey's dad, and Case out of Richmond, consistently came to that city council, and ultimately that officer had to leave, and real issues have developed. We've been involved in other cases where protesting counts, and meeting and going to the city council, going to various public meetings, and letting your position be known matters. And you know, one of the cases I've been involved in, people will respond, political people respond to public pressure. Cops obviously will take their position. We will always support them, no matter what. But you can never, as I say, never accept the official position. But part of what you have to do as citizens is to challenge that position. And maybe later you may find out that position is correct. But mostly it's not.
That's right.
And you then have to ask that question. So part of the lessons that we have out of it, that the community came together timely in an organized fashion, made demands, caused a prosecution to take place, caused BART ultimately to have to relook at its policies, and ultimately, I think, through consistent efforts, got a review panel, public auditor in place. That would not have happened but for the political pressure that came about from the community.
A video has emerged tonight that captures the tense moments leading up to a BART police officer shooting that killed a man on New Year's Day.
The camera shifted to an officer trying to arrest one man when another officer's gun fired behind them. 22-year-old Hayward resident Oscar Grant was hit by the officer's bullet. He later died.
It's 2009, feeling fine from the party after New Year's Eve. You know the train's getting rowdy and having a couple drinks doesn't make me an alky. People started fighting and somebody pointed out me. Here come the bar police charging me. I don't off the beef, I'm a father, please. I got a little girl at home, she only 4 years old. She my world, my flesh and bone, his tears started to roll. If they just looked him in his eye, they could see clear with soul, but these cops only understand fear and control. Face down on the ground in a prone position, bystanders start recording, cell phones are flipping, thinking he's another brother on the road to prison. They have no idea they gonna witness a lynching. The young brother was clinching, but he wasn't resisting it.
Johannes Mesery
made a fatal decision as he rose to his feet and took hold of his seat. The entire train station froze in disbelief. Oscar the father, barely over 20, with gold in the dreams of household and family. His last seconds on earth, he didn't know it could be. Only the dirty train station flow he could see. You hear the bullet explode through his fleece. You won't see an execution that cold in the streets. Damn, you see what happened? That cop started snapping. Cell phones they was grabbing. I had mine in the lining of my jacket. That cop was a cold-hearted bastard. Shooting them in the back is an act of a savage. A flash from the gap that snatched your soul future. You can lose your life just by being a commuter. As soon as I get home, I upload from my computer to YouTube entitled "The Cowardly Police Shooter." The rally's at 3 o'clock at the station up the block. The sign that I got says "Jail Law Killer Cops." I'm hot, to say the least. Especially at the police chief, who said the proof is inconclusive.
I think it's inconclusive. We need to talk to all the officers, and especially the primary.
You seen the video, man, them cops is ruthless. I'm tired of the silence and the goddamn excuses. Why we always be the one with the bruises in the back of the police cruisers? Now I see cops in riot gear surround the protest. It's a peaceful demonstration, we don't pose no threat. Mr. Officer, do you have a child? If someone shot him in the back, would you want him on trial? Would you want the DA and the mayor to vow that you would get justice for act so foul? Man, I'm sick of all this waiting. I want justice right now. To hell with all the yelling. It's time for the rebellion. Rebellion.
It's been 7 days. What's wrong with that, Mayor? You used to be a congressman. You're a lawmaker. You've been a lawmaker before. What's wrong with the law right now? It's not working for the people, man. And man, you out here and you can sell that stuff to people that really don't know. But the intelligent people here really understand.
What are you saying?
What I'm saying is, sir, is that why couldn't you have come earlier?
Let me tell you, I was doing something earlier.
How can you have a first-class cosmopolitan city when you're the mayor of a city that just had an execution, when you can go to New York City with Rudolph Giuliani, who had an adversarial relationship with the citizens, and he gave a press conference the day after Amadou Diallo got shot? shot. Michael Bloomberg gave a press conference that night that Sean Bell got shot. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa gave a press conference the same day that the police shot up and beat up all the Latinos during the Immigration May Day march. Right? We can go all around the country. You know, there's a press conference by Israel when they drop bombs on Gaza the same day. So you're the mayor of a city that already seen its history drenched in blood of police killing from Bobby Hutton all the way up to Gary King to now. And then you can't even just speak to the people as a human being?
We have to begin to organize in a way to where we can begin, we're unified and committed enough to make the sacrifices it takes. Because if black people said, or poor people said, or oppressed people said, we're not going to ride BART, then it would bankrupt BART. But we got to be organized enough, committed enough, and unified enough to make that happen.
Well, there you go. We've been out here this week with your Siri X.
Hard Knock Radio, East, West, hard North, South, radio, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous, speaking to the thugs. One love, we know where y'all at. Top Brown Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415's bumpin' Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. And to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from this hard knock, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks, learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side, learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks, learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side. Like a pocket, 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 like a pocket